of the constitutional conversations that we are going to be having with you to just tell you a little bit about our research and how it relates to constitutional law. As the people in Section A know, I was born and raised in Germany and I came to Canada 20 years ago. And I've always looked at Canadian politics and Canadian constitutional law with a comparative eye in mind. And because I'm also a migrant, and because I also happen to be the mother of what's called a displaced person, so somebody who was raised in a part of Germany that is now Poland, but who had to flee from that part because the Russian army after the Second World War was moving in with her mother at the age of 5, I always grew up with stories of leaving and stories of what's called forced migration, because certainly my mother and my grandmother did not want to leave her home, but they had to because otherwise terrible things would have happened to them, and obviously there was also a regime change in that part of the country, so it was really something that they had to do. So when I was in my graduate work, and I was actually one of the last classes that Peter Russell was teaching on constitutional politics at the University of Toronto, I thought, well, something that I've always wondered, but I hadn't had a chance to get involved with, was that as a German, I'm so familiar with this article in the German Constitution that says that people fleeing political persecution have a right to asylum in Germany. Article 16 of the German Basic Law decrees that. And there has now since been a little bit of an amendment to that that's caused quite a bit of controversy. But Germany was alone amongst a lot of industrialized nations and having a very broad right to asylum enshrined in its constitution. Yet at the same time, knowing the German political scene, I think I was surprised how much controversy and reluctance there was about accepting migrants that come to Germany as refugees, despite this constitutional provision that was clearly put in place after World War II, and there were big negotiations and discussions when Germany's constitution was put in place, how broad this right to asylum should be. And it was decreed at the time that the right to asylum really should be as broad as possible because Germany had some forgiving to do and really needed to throw its doors open. So when I came to Canada, I was of course intrigued to find out in this nation of immigrants and a nation that's known and recognized for its commitment to take in refugees, how this all worked in Canada. So you would imagine my surprise when I was in Peter Russell's class and I attempted to do this comparative paper, when I was looking at constitutional provisions in Canada's constitution, it was like my surprise. There was nothing there that mentioned the word asylum seekers, refugees, seeking refuge. And then I learned that it was just, how can you call it, a roundabout way in which the right to life, liberty, and security of the person, Section 7 of the Charter, has become the center hook and points for what you would call refugee rights in Canada. But before I talk a little bit more how that led to my research, I just wanted to make sure that everybody in the room knows what some of the other grounds are under which people can seek protection. Because some of you might not know what the definition of a refugee is, because there's also international law. Some of you might have heard of the Geneva Conventions. And so does anybody want to tell me what else counts as protection from persecution, what some of the grounds might be, what some of the scenarios might be, just so that we're clear on the definition of what a refugee is under the Geneva Convention. My section knows I'm a lively, interactive person, so don't be shy because there are more people here. Any more guesses? What's a refugee? Helga.
Religious.
Yes, religious persecution. Excellent.
Political persecution.
What's that?
Political.
Political persecution, yes. That's a really interesting one, because there is something about Who is doing the persecuting? Is it a state or a government? Or is it, in the Taliban case, is there a civil war going on in that society? And under the original interpretation of the Geneva Convention, it had to be a state who was not willing to protect their people anymore, but who was persecuting them for reasons of religion, political persuasion, etc., etc. So it's something along those lines. But this is actually a critical distinction between Canadian and German asylum law, was that for a long time, Germany accepted only refugees where there was a clear link to a state persecuting people. While in Canada, Canada was much earlier willing to accept the reality that wars are not like the Second World War anymore, where one state fights another, but that more people are being affected in civil war areas, and that countries break apart, colonial regimes break apart, and that there are people fleeing because there are different factions fighting each other. So in terms of differences in interpretation of some of these criteria, Germany believed that if you're from Afghanistan, well, you know, that was not a, if you were fleeing the Taliban, then you were not fit the profile of the Geneva Convention definition. So this person would not have been accepted as a refugee right away. So that's already another part of the definition. But so political persecution, religion, any other criteria that you can imagine.
Sexual?
Yeah, what about sexual? Do you wanna, what do you mean? Because there are two different ways in which one could interpret that one. Is it sexual? Okay, sexual. So you mean sexual orientation?
Yes.
Yes. What else? Gender persecution? Okay. So in the area of sexual orientation and gender persecution, imagine that the Geneva Convention comes out of Second World War. Again, although there were sexual minorities persecuted by the Nazis, the classic definition of the Geneva Convention has nothing to do and did not care so much about sexual minorities or gender-based persecution. So it was only through jurisprudence and through actually the leadership of Canada that something like gender-based persecution, so women fearing for their lives in some countries and then coming to countries like Canada, that we now, in most societies, accept that that's a valid ground for persecution. Same with sexual orientation, because that's also something that society had to accept first. Yes?
How about ethnicity?
Ethnicity, yeah. That is also part, I think, in this background social criteria. So there is something in the Geneva Convention definition, if we were getting into this, that would talk about social criteria. And that definitely would have fit for, again, the classic World War II origin, the Jewish community, some people argued was an ethnic group, other people argued it was a religious group. So that's where this definition is coming from. But it's changed quite a bit if you think about gender and sexual orientation. And of course, the courts are critical to this. But a question is, how did the courts even become involved if you have no way of translating? Yeah, this is the other interesting tidbit. In Canada, so this Geneva Convention thing was written after World War II, 1952, there was an amendment in 1969, but any guesses as to when Canada acceded to the Geneva Convention, so decided that it was willing to accept this definition of a refugee? Since Canada is like a country that's big on immigrants and refugees, do you think they were there right in 1952? Any guesses as to why? If you have a nation of immigrants, then Canada has a tradition of picking its immigrants. So if you accede to an international convention and you give away some of your sovereignty, then you agree to a uniform interpretation of what it means to be a refugee. And then, of course, we need national courts, we need bureaucratic decision makers who implement all this kind of stuff. But Canada was not, in 1952, ready to accept all this and build a bureaucratic structure around it. So it happened, it happened in the 1960s when Canada's immigration law was becoming much more open. And in the 1960s and in the 1970s, there was a big general shift in Canada's immigration law. That's when you might have heard about the point system. There was more talk about human rights in Canadian law in general. But this is all still pre-1982 charter, right? So if you're talking about giving rights to refugees, giving rights to immigrants, if you don't have a constitutional document in the Canadian case that provides a list of rights, and you as a society don't really have a tradition of a written Bill of Rights, okay, there was Canadian Bill of Rights in the 1960s, it's still difficult if you are somebody who's claiming refugee status in Canada and you're being denied to then challenge this interpretation, because you need an institutional structure around this. And if you, and in Canada prior to the charter, it was all still fairly discretionary. There was an ad hoc committee, and it seemed like over time Canada was slowly building institutional structures, and my hands are sort of drawing these institutional structures here. But in Germany, the courts were involved right from the beginning for perhaps historical reasons. Some people argue because Germany had a constitutional provision that says, yes, there should be refuge granted here if you have valid grounds. But it's interesting, and this is something that I was doing in parts of my dissertation to understand why we perceive these two countries to be so similar in some ways, and Germany has quantitatively taken in a lot of refugees. Canada has as well, but it's because Canada has been much more generous and Germany has been more restrictive, but Germany, for geopolitical reasons, has been getting more people because it's easier to come to some European countries than to come to isolated Canada. But if you want to understand why the courts play such a prominent role, because when I met Ian, we were talking about some of the big court cases, like the famous Singh case that everybody thinks is like the founding case for refugee rights and the connection of refugees to the charter, that was really something that just did not exist. So in my research, I was just fascinated by the contrast, and the contrast really animated how I was unfolding my research and why I was going back further in time historically, because I was trying to understand why these two societies were so different. Because it's not just that you have an immigrant society and a country that's quite reluctant to take in immigrants, but there are institutional structures and there are organizations that go to court to challenge the existing rules and institutional structures. There are courts that are more interested in refugee rights than in others. So that was really the puzzle that I was unraveling in some part of my dissertation research. But it really started with a very fundamental question around, well, why is it something I'm so used to in this society and it's so different in another society, yet we think that Canada is such an advanced society, such a proactive society when it comes to taking in refugees. But in 2012, we still don't have a right to appeal a negative refugee decision. It's quite discretionary because somebody has to first ask the federal court for permission to have them review this decision. There will at some point be a bureaucratic appeal division whenever the government gets its act together. But the institutional structures between the two countries are so different. And again, trying to unravel this puzzle was what took me a number of years. Ian was involved with this. And I could say lots more about this, but I think I'm probably at least at my 10 minutes, so I will. Are we going to take questions first?
And then, I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I hope I've left you interested in more. If you are interested in more, I'm happy to chat with you some more about my topic. But it's just supposed to give you an example of how somebody arrived at a question, a puzzle, and then constructed a research project around this. And I interviewed judges, bureaucratic officials. I went to refugee hearings in the two countries, but I also worked with historical documents and ended up in the Canadian historical case in 1910 because there was this big battle between the courts and the executive about how much courts should be involved in immigration. And so it was really funny where some research projects take you, but it's really, if you're shopping for an MRP project, a major research paper project, I can only encourage you to find something that you're passionate about. And it's always good to have a question or a puzzle, because that will really drive your inquiry, because you will want to unravel this and you will want to find the answer. And since I'm in the qualitative research camp, and my colleague Thaddeus Wong, who you already encountered, who also works on courts, is much more of a quantitative scholar, I'm happy to talk to you about how different methods can also generate valid evidence. And Ian has done a lot more work with court documents and court decisions than I have, so I've taken much more of bigger historical and societal factors into account. But again, I'm happy to answer questions if you have any, and then you can get a little bit of an insight into what Professor Green is doing. Oh, and at the moment I'm writing, just to tell you where I'm at the moment, I'm writing a chapter on immigration federalism. That's sort of a sexy term in some of the literature at the moment, because in the United States you may have heard that states like Arizona suddenly seem to be much more active in immigration policy making. And that's traditionally not something that subnational levels of government like US states have really been doing, because that's been more a federal government responsibility. So in terms of federalism, it's usually been the feds that have been doing this. So trying to understand this in a comparative context is something that I'm trying to finish up right now. And so this is part of an edited collection that looks at a number of different federations. But there was a question already. Danielle.
I wondered if you spoke in your research to refugee claimants and how they shape their narratives based on the differences between claimants and claimants to Germany and Canada, and how that shapes the perception.
I talked to some lawyers and I talked to some claimants, and there are very different perceptions as to how important the shaping of the narrative is, because clearly it's important so that you state things in the right language so that the person on the other end who makes the decision understands you properly. But in the German context, there's a lot of cynicism around the coaching of refugee claimants. And in Germany, there are attempts to cut off the claimant from the lawyer so that the real story of the true refugee, see me putting this in quotation marks, emerges. And I think in Canada, there's always been an effort to connect the person with a lawyer. And again, if you think about the two different stereotypical societies, Canada has been more restrictive lately as well, but the overarching narrative has been that Canada has believed that providing refugee claimants with access to somebody who helps them with their narrative and who helps them communicate, because they might be traumatized, they might not want to share all of their story, that might be a reason that in the German setting I was in a hearing, and it was interesting just to see what the interpreters do in exactly this context, because how this is translated, what the nationality of the interpreter is often also critical to how the story then arrives in the decision maker's ears, and how some of these contradictions are being perceived by the decision makers. Yeah, but that's a really important question. Any other questions?
So,
do you want to speak up so that those people can hear you?
My question is that since the German constitution was kind of imposed by the United States, and since the United States believes in separation of powers, and that probably mirrors in Germany, is it possible that in Germany it mirrors that free the refugees and people in need from the executive and put them equal in law, while in Canada, is it the case that Canadian system of government believes in executive powers and not really separation, and control the refugee and our immigrants and how they will act or act?
You would think, just to paraphrase this so how I understand the question, you would think that you have a bunch of victorious allies who are writing a constitution and who are putting something so fundamental in as the right to asylum. And the Germans were also considered, and there are some really interesting transcripts of the conversations at the time. I think the Germans were very much on board with how this was written, But the German Federation that the Allies constructed was, like Canada initially, actually a very decentralized federation. So if you look at the division of powers in the German Basic Law, in the Constitution, the written version is quite decentralized. And the reason for that was because the Allies wanted to divide up the very centralized Nazi state. But when it came to asylum, it became at some point unworkable to only have one government agency and one court dealing with all the refugees that were coming in. So eventually in the 70s, refugee procedures were actually federalized, and so there are now reception facilities in all the different German states. All the courts in all the different states deal with refugee cases if there is an appeal. So the federal structure in Germany definitely took over. And there was never this perception that, in the US context, the perception is that courts should not interfere with anything to do with foreign policy. That's called the plenary power doctrine. That's something that the US Supreme Court at some point established. That's actually never been the case in German constitutional law. I didn't understand the connection to Canada. If you want to restate that one for me.
The connection to Canada is, since, as you were saying earlier, the Canadian government has always managed immigration themselves.
Right.
And they did not want the courts to have any say on it. And it is very much how the executive power is seen in Canada, as, you know, independent of judiciary.
Yes, and I think that's exactly very true. But there was, even in the pre-charter days, and this is again where I have to go back to my favorite period in 1910, where there were no written rights, there were still people trying to get into Canada that were being deported or that were being detained, that were challenging their deportation and their detention using what at the time was standing in for rights claims, and that was actually federalism. So they were saying that the federal government was overstepping its jurisdiction in X, Y, and Z at the time, because they didn't have a language of rights. But they were going very much against exactly what you said, that the executive felt that it could pick and choose who would come to Canada without having to justify this in any rights framework, because it was all about the discretionary admission of people who Canada thought would best fit its national image. So that's definitely true. Last round of questions? No? Obaid?
Yeah, just as Canadians, independent of the
speak up a tad. It's the fan.
Independent of international conventions.
Right.
Do you think that our immigration laws and mechanisms we accept refugees will calculate the benefit of Canada? Just say again,
a political question. I think what's it called in English, the Achilles heel, so the vulnerable spot in the Canadian regime is really that there is no proper right to appeal. And the fear is that if you give people the right to appeal, then they will stay in the country longer, and these are the people we don't want anyway. But if you don't re-examine their claim, and there might be some issues that Danielle brought up in terms of how their story was translated, because perhaps they were traumatized, because maybe the translator was at fault. So if you don't have somebody looking over this more thoroughly in perhaps a court of law or an administrative body, and there is no right of that claimant, I think that's really what I find personally problematic in the Canadian system, and that's also the person in me who believes in rights and the rule of law, and not just in administrative discretion. So that's something that I find not so good about the Canadian system. Where Canada is also moving is that there's, I think, a lot of trying to keep people from even getting to Canada. So you've probably heard about all the visa requirements that are imposed on certain nationals of certain countries. There are also more attempts to, if there is a boat arriving, my colleague Audrey Macklin would say, to really stigmatize the people that come on a boat and think that somebody who comes in on a really rotten ship and arrives at the shores of British Columbia, who's, you know, been on this vessel that maybe could have sunk all along the way, that they have less of a claim than some other people do. And so I think there is something that seems to be changing in the Canadian policy, because this has had policy implications, and I worry about that, because Canada has been more welcoming, and I think Canada could afford to bring some people in that aren't just $500,000 business immigrants, but this is, you know, we're at York University, so I think I fit in that respect. I fit some of the, I'm very critical because I care about vulnerable communities, and so I really think if somebody can only afford a passage on a rotten ship and really so desperately wants another life that they dare to board such a vessel, I guess I would want to hear why they want to come to Canada. They might not fit this definition that we talked about, the refugee definition, but maybe there's another reason why they should deserve to actually be admitted to Canada. But of course, yeah, there could be smugglers, there could be gangs, there could be people from all sorts of problematic areas, but I guess I would at least want to give them a chance. So that's my very personal, and you can completely disagree with me. I have no problem with that, because like you will see in my other half of my class, I love debate and discussion. So if you totally disagree, don't fear. This is a very open conversation. But that's my personal response. How many questions can we take?
Let's just take one more.
A whole bunch. I don't know who was first. Do you want to just... It's Ronald? Okay.
In your research, did you specifically refugee? I always hear this term, that one, but more specific on the immigration things. But did you find any specific tap on, like refugee?
You mean that the tap is turned on from certain countries?
Yeah. What's the quota for this year?
Oh, okay. I can answer that one, because you guys may know or may not know that the Minister of Immigration has to table a report in Parliament where they kind of plan how many immigrants come to Canada. And the big ballpark figure has usually been 250,000 immigrants in general, and then it's always been plus minus 25,000 refugees. But Canada has refugees that it picks overseas in refugee camps, and then it screens them over there and then invites them to come. There's a sponsorship program, and that's a very different way because they get picked, right? I use that word quite deliberately. Or you have the people on the boats coming from the US that come. But there is a quota figure in that respect. But I don't know in terms of taps. It assumes that people have control over how and when they come, and that there is a conflict in a certain area, and maybe that then gets people, like the question is, where will all the Syrian refugees go? They're all in Turkey at the moment, but the EU is already trying to decide what they're going to do, and then Canada, I'm sure, is also trying to decide how many people Canada will take from Syria. So some conflicts caused the tap to be turned on, I guess. But I don't know. Sometimes people think that's the push and pull factor. I wasn't sure if that's what you were getting at. I don't think that, again, somebody who can't afford to fly to Canada and get that visa, that they have so much control over when and how they come. Maybe if you're in Iraq at a certain time and you pay a smuggler, because that was the only way at this particular day and this particular time you knew the border was going to be open and you had enough money for your family, that was the only way to get out. But it just complicates things in terms of should Canada then not be accepting that person if they made it to a reception camp. So there are all sorts of questions one could ask. But Canada does have a proactive strategy, so they have a big number. And sometimes it meets the number, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes, historically speaking, like, for example, from Vietnam, people have been brought in that were outside of those planning numbers. So I think over time, Canada has been quite generous outside of this planning. But the planning assumes that Canadian population doesn't grow as much, that we need people for job purposes, right? And that's all discussed in the House of Commons. And that's quite interesting to see what the discussions are. I hope I answered your question. If you have more questions, I'm happy to answer them later,
yes,
or in one of the subsequent weeks.
Come for a glass of wine after this class in the McLaughlin Courtyard, and we'd be happy to answer your questions even more openly.
Hey, I answered the big what I think is wrong with Canadian policy in like this entire class. So,
so I'll say just a little bit about my research.
Do I need to introduce Professor Green? So he introduced me.
Go ahead.
Ian and I met many years ago also on a, he was my very first discussant of a conference paper I ever gave. And it was quite intimidating because if you're a young graduate student and there are some very senior people who will be reading your work, it's quite intimidating. So I really wondered what he and somebody else who was on this panel, Miriam was the chair, one of our colleagues here at York, Miriam Smith, was the chair for this panel, but he was his usual generous, very positive self about my writing, and I think we've always stayed in touch. And then when I came to York, I learned that he's this person who I think nobody wants that he will ever retire, because what will McLaughlin College do without him? So if you are around York, you will see him in his, it's Scottish?
Bagpipes.
In his Scottish with his bagpipes and in his, in his Scottish kilt and everything, because he really loves students so much that he's really so dedicated to McLaughlin. But the judicial community also knows, I think, how dedicated he is to contributing and providing evidence for what they're doing. And I think he's managed to really bridge the academic divide in a number of different ways.
Thank you. Well, in the shortly after I came to York University in 1985, I heard Madam Justice Wilson give a talk, and she was critical of academics because she said when she was appointed to the Supreme Court of Canada, she was looking for writing about how appeal court judges make their decisions. And there was nothing. So I thought, well, that's a really good idea for a research project. So along with four colleagues, we applied for funding from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council. And what we did is we ended up interviewing almost all the appellate court judges in Canada in all the provinces, and the Supreme Court of Canada and the Federal Court of Appeal. And we asked them all a number of questions about how they make their decisions. One of our colleagues was Coral Barr, who studies case flow. So he insisted that we select a random sample of 5,000 cases across Canada, of cases that went from trial to appeal to and some to the Supreme Court of Canada, just so that we could see all the events along the way. And it was a fascinating project, because what we learned was that every province is different. For example, we have one criminal code, and yet the quantity of cases, criminal cases, varies from province to province, sometimes because of local characteristics, but sometimes because of the way the judges make their decisions. And this encourages certain types of litigation and discourages others. I remember attending a meeting of the Federal Appeal Court judges, and they were saying to each other, well, it's wonderful to have this meeting, but it's a waste of time because we all do things the same way. And they don't. In Alberta, for example, they encourage, and Ontario, they encourage people who are incarcerated to appeal their sentences. They don't do that in the other provinces. In Quebec, the appeal court judges have a lead judge who reads all the materials and tells the other judges what to read, because they have stacks of reading material. They don't do that in the other provinces. Well, they do in Saskatchewan now to some extent too. So they're all different in the way that they approach the job, and I found it real, and the impact of their decision making is different. It results in different case flow in different provinces. So I think that as a result of our work, the judges learn from that, and they can improve the way they do things by seeing the way their colleagues in other provinces do things. The other area of research that I do is ethics and politics, and I've been fascinated by the growth of the institution of independent ethics commissioner. The first one was in 1988 in Ontario. All the provinces now have an independent ethics commissioner. Most of them actually meet with members of the legislature to explain the rules. That's the most important thing they do, is they educate the members about the ethics rules to prevent them from getting into trouble. And then if there's a complaint that someone has violated the rules, they'll investigate immediately so it isn't dragged out through the courts for months, thus reducing our trust in politicians. So it's called the Canadian model. It works very well. It's been exported to other countries now. The only place it doesn't work is in the House of Commons. And the reason for that?
Ethics.
The reason for that is because there's no requirement for MPs to meet with the commissioner to understand the rules. So only about 5% of cabinet ministers meet with the commissioner. They think they know it all, and that's why we have so many ethics scandals federally. And only about 50% of the elected members meet. So that's something I'm writing about all the time and trying to change, because regardless of the party in power, I want to see them behave ethically, and I want to see them stay out of trouble, because we need to trust our politicians if we're going to defend our democracy. I'm also really interested in the growth of lobbyist commissioners and the tremendous growth of municipal conflict of interest commissioners in recent years. On October 16th, where actually all the municipal conflict of interest commissioners in Ontario are meeting here in McLaughlin College, and they'll be giving a lunch talk for any of you who are available during lunch. I'll be advertising that to you, so please come and meet them. Now, if only Rob Ford had met with the ethics commissioner.
I was thinking that.
That's why he keeps on getting into trouble, because he thinks he knows it. He actually gave a lunch talk here a couple of years ago.
Oh my God.
And he thought he knew everything. And that's why he keeps getting into trouble. Anyway, some people, even if there's legislation to force them to meet, won't do it. So those are the two areas of research I'm really interested in. Oh, the third area is I've been an expert witness in four cases. One case went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. And I got really interested in the impact of expert witnesses on Supreme Court decisions and other court decisions. So I've got dozens of the complete transcripts of many cases, and I'm looking at the impact of expert witness. It's really important to work with a lawyer who can explain what the expert does, and it's really important for the expert to understand how the judicial system works, and many experts don't. So I hope that through that research, the process can be improved as well.
That's also really important in my topic, because there are lots of experts that come and give testimony on country-specific situations in the immigration context, and there's a huge debate about which expert is called, how they're called, whether they're qualified or not. So totally related.
And finally, I've been doing research into unnecessary delays in courts for many years, and as a result of my sins, I'm going to Jamaica tomorrow morning to advise on how they can reduce unnecessary delays. So I won't be replying to any of your emails for at least a week.
Oh, we feel very sorry for you.
And I hope many of you will consider taking the court organization and management course Thursday evenings in the winter term. There's no extra charge. Then you can graduate with a diploma in justice system administration. And over wine, you can ask me more about that. But now, any questions?
End of that. I think that's very intriguing, and I'm just wondering, when you embarked on that, were there many people that were crawling under a rock to hide, thinking that the municipal level has gone without scrutiny for a very long time? So I think now that they have this opportunity to have their dirty laundry aired, that perhaps there might be some talk out there to
well.
Things.
In every single province and federally, when an independent ethics commissioner was suggested, there was always pushback. No, I'm ethical. We don't need that. But underneath that was, boy, they're going to, I'm going to be accused of things that I didn't do, and it's going to be, awful. So we can't have this. David Miller was the person who brought in this system in Toronto. And so you need that sort of leadership to bring it in. But the most important function of the commissioner is not to investigate complaints, but keep councillors and the mayor outside of the limelight by saying, these are the rules, and if this is how you follow them, you'll stay out of the front page of the paper. And if you have any questions, come and see me. I'm here to help you, not to hurt you. Okay, so it sometimes takes a crisis for a municipal government to say, well, things are just so bad, we can't get any worse with a commissioner. And then, but always, once they have that system in place, they like it, because they realize it really helps them, if they use it.
Do you think the Walkerton water scandal would fit into that, or the municipal level, but it also infiltrated other levels of government? Do you think that would fit in?
That had nothing to do with a conflict of interest. It had to do with poorly thought out legislation and incompetent people running the show. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Yes.
Ezra.
Are any of these talks, podcasts, webcasts,
Yes. Yes. What we try to do for most of the McLaughlin Lunch Talks is to video them, and then a few weeks later they're posted to the McLaughlin webpage and on YouTube, so you can see them there. Just go to the McLaughlin webpage tab, click on Academics, and if they're up there, you can click on it and it'll come up. Well, maybe we should head back to our classes then.
Can I put one plug in, since you put a plug in for your class?
Sure.
If any of you are interested in, I know some of you are in fairly steady employment, other people are thinking about switching employment. I'm, as part of the German European Study Center, have just sent in the last year 3 second year MPAL students to Europe to go and learn about the EU and its institutions, and also to do internship work in the EU. There was also a 4th year undergraduate PPA student who went, and there is a Canada-wide network of universities that sends undergraduate and master students to the EU on a what's called a study tour. That's about 2 weeks, so there are about 50 Canadian students that go with a former EU diplomat and a bunch of faculty on this tour, visit all sorts of EU institutions and really get the inside scoop, because this guy really has the connections. So I'm the person at York who takes applications and who advocates about this to send people to go. And the MPAL students that went will also be giving, once they're all back, will be giving a talk on their experiences. One person worked in Vienna at the EU Human Rights Agency. There were a couple of people who worked for a human trafficking NGO that's part of the Council of Europe. There was somebody who worked for a liberal think tank in Brussels, so there are quite a few interesting opportunities. York has some funds to support these internships. There are some travel funds. There have also been bursaries from the MPAL program, because that's the sad story about internships, is that to get your foot in the door, you have to work for free. But I have talked to so many people who've gone on these programs that I cannot not advertise them. So if you are interested, we would be sending second year students, but it's something I know that a lot of people here reflect on their career. Some people want to switch, and so it's just something for you to think about, and I'm happy to talk to you some more about that. Same goes with the internships at Queen's Park, and since we have a former federal intern here, if you are maybe interested in real politics, then I'm also happy to advise, because I have a second year MPAL student who's interested in applying for the Ontario internship. Okay, that's it from the plug on my end.
Final plug for the French for Public Administration course. We only have 3 MPAL students in it right now. We have a $2,000 to distribute. The cost is $900, but we have $2,000 to distribute amongst the MPAL students who take it. So it starts Thursday evenings, either end of September, beginning of October, so you still have a chance to apply. And then there's 2 Saturdays at the end of November that they have it. So please consider that, and you'll get some kind of subsidy depending on how many MPAL students are in it.
Yeah, and your French has to be somewhat half-decent, mm-hmm. because it's really building on some half-decent French and giving you that vocabulary that you will need in the public sector, which of course for federal government jobs in particular is really big. Question over.
I was just going to say, I just went to the assessment on Friday. Mm-hmm. They're starting to get really bumped up, so it's really important that people get
okay.
in as soon as possible with the assessment.
Okay. But you went, so good.
Yeah. Okay.
So just go to the webpage and you can learn much more about it.
There are a couple more questions over there.
Chi? I just wanted to ask one question about...
Speak up.
I just wanted to ask one
better?
Question about the leadership class.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Professor Caravaggio suggested that he might run a second session, maybe beginning in November or beginning in the new year, at a time that would be convenient for you folks. The problem is, if we have it downtown, we can't afford renting another classroom, because this is free. So we'd have to have it up here somewhere. So let me consult with your class representatives, and we'll try to come up with a solution that is convenient for as many of you as possible. I get back from Jamaica.
The downtown classroom is owned by Osgood and by York, and so we rent from the law school, right? And that's mm-hmm. not a cheap endeavor. Just the realities of universities. There was one more question, I thought. Somebody else had their hands up on French for...
I was just going to ask about
they will test you. You have to have some basic, like high school French. You don't have to be fluent, but you have to have that basic building block to build upon. Yes?
Helga?
The diploma in Justice System Administration? Yes, if you take the 6140 course, it's Thursday nights next term, or else you can take it in your second year. And I'm very lenient with regard to assignments because I know you have a very heavy course load. So you take that course. You have to have done a 12-week internship somewhere in the justice system. We'll get you involved in projects if you haven't been involved in the justice system so far. And your major research paper or topics paper has to have something to do with justice system administration. Then you'll get the diploma in addition to your degree. Yes? No? Okay.
Can I just ask you guys to, at the end of class, return your name tags? Because we would like to know who you are again next time around. I'm the person who is big on learning names because I think it's so important for us to make a connection with you, and names are really critical to remembering a little bit more about you. So can you just make sure that you don't leave without dropping it off on the big pile so that I can take them back to my office and guard them until next class?